log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
U.S. Republican Senator Mitt Romney, Congresswoman Liz Cheney and others recently helped kill off a voting rights bill that Democrats claim is essential to protecting democracy from a Trump-driven onslaught. We now present you an article written by David Smith. The piece is titled U.S. Republican Resistance to Trump Rings Hollow as So-Called Moderates Say No on Voting Rights. U.S. Senator Mitt Romney, Congresswoman Liz Cheney and others were hailed as the so-called conscience of the Republican Party. But their deeds in the Senate have provoked accusations of hypocrisy. They have been hailed as the purported heroes of the resistance to former U.S. President Donald Trump's hostile takeover. But Senator Mitt Romney, Liz Cheney and others recently helped kill off a voting rights bill that Democrats claim is essential to protecting democracy from a Trump-driven onslaught. The blanket opposition from these Republicans is provoking criticism that their rejection of the ex-president rings hollow, and despite their words, they are ultimately helping further his authoritarian agenda. Latosha Brown, co-founder of Black Voters Matter, said, "They might not like Trump, but they have the character of Trump. The reason why Trump was able to lead their party is because he claimed that he is a good representation. He's a liar. They lie. They've decided to use any means necessary to maintain power. If that means political corruption, they decide that they're going to go that route." Black Voters Matter and other groups warn the Republican-led states across the country are passing laws making it more difficult for African Americans and others to vote by consolidating polling locations, requiring certain types of identification, and ordering other changes. In response, Democrats in the House of Representatives recently passed the Freedom to Vote, John R. Lewis Act, which would make Election Day a national holiday, ensure access to early voting and mail-in ballots, and enable the Justice Department to intervene in states with a history of voter interference. The legislation was also supported by all 50 Democrats in the Senate, but collapsed in recent days when Republicans used a procedural rule known as the filibuster to block it in the evenly divided chamber. Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, then called on a vote on changing Senate rules to allow the chamber to pass the bill by a simple majority vote. Again, all Republicans were opposed, and now they were joined by Democrats Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, ensuring a 52-48 defeat. It was a bitter defeat for President Joe Biden just hours after he held a marathon press conference on Wednesday, 19th of January, marking the end of his first year in office. The president said in a statement, "I am profoundly disappointed." Much liberal fury was focused on Democratic holdouts Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, but their intransigence only mattered because all the Republicans, including so-called moderates, stood firm against legislation that aims to combat voter suppression, which largely impacts communities of color. Even those who claim to be fiercely anti-Trump. Mitt Romney, a former presidential nominee, is a prime example. He was the only senator to break with his party by voting to convict Donald Trump for abuse of power in his first impeachment trial in 2020. He was then one of seven Republicans to find Donald Trump guilty of incitement of insurrection at his second impeachment trial last year. Yet, by then, Romney, senator for Utah, had already spelled out his opposition to the voting rights legislation, dismissing it as a partisan takeover of federal elections, and even comparing it to Trump's false claim of election rigging in 2020. Mitt Romney was not alone. Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska, who also voted to convict Donald Trump at last year's impeachment trial, described the push to defend voting rights as a charade to satisfy a minority addicted to rage on Twitter, adding, "It's bad for America. It's just as undermining of public trust in elections as what Donald Trump did last year." Senators Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Rob Portman and Tim Scott, all of whom have spoke out against Donald Trump at various times, opposed the bill. In the earlier House vote, Never Trumpers Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger also towed the party line. Liz Cheney, vice chairwoman of the House Select Committee investigating the 6th of January insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, has earned bipartisan admiration from some unlikely quarters. New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman even floated the idea of her becoming Joe Biden's running mate in the 2024 election. But the daughter of former Vice President Dick Cheney made clear last year she did not see connection between Trump's big lie about 2020 and the blitz of voter restrictions imposed by Republican state legislatures. Liz Cheney told Axios website, "For example, I will never understand the resistance to voter ID." Some commentators agree that there is nothing inconsistent about decrying Trump's assault on democracy and rejecting Democrats' sweeping proposals. Michael Steele, the first African-American to serve as chairman of the Republican National Committee, said, "You can be against Donald Trump and have a policy view on voting rights. I would personally maybe disagree with it. That would not lead them to support the proposed legislation in the House or the Senate." But some conservative critics of Donald Trump admit that the reforms, which they regard as an example of government overreach at the expense of states' autonomy, even though Article 1 of the Constitution explicitly authorizes Congress to set federal election rules, put them in a quandary. Joe Walsh, a former Republican congressman from Illinois, said, "I'm vehemently anti-Trump, but anti what the Democrats are trying to do at the federal level. So I'd be in the same grouping. Republicans are doing a bunch of work with little value, but the answer to that, in my mind, is not bad on constitutional federal legislation." But Joe Walsh objects to Mitt Romney's attempt to equate Donald Trump's lies with Joe Biden's policy. Joe Walsh said, "I disagree with Mitt Romney and any other Republican that's making any sort of comparisons between what Trump did to our elections and what Democrats are doing." The recent vote was also the latest marker of the Republican Party's transformation in the Trump era. 16 of its current senators voted to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act in 2006, but opposed the latest bill, which would update the most powerful part of the law. Republican presidents Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush all supported its renewal. Antoine Seawright, a senior advisor to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, took issue with Mitt Romney and colleagues' claim that Republicans are not making it harder for minorities to vote. Antoine Seawright said, "It's intellectually dishonest for anyone to say that there's not an effort to suppress, suffocate and silence the votes of black people, in particular around this country. All you have to do is look at the bills that have been filed and where they have been filed. With the voting rights measures aimed at safeguarding democracy now apparently dead in the water, it may be harder for independents, liberals and others to heap praise on anti-Trump Republicans in quite the same way as before." Kurt Bardella, an advisor to the Democratic National Committee, argues that doing the right thing once does not make them heroes, adding, "Just because you're anti-Trump doesn't mean you're still not part of the anti-democratic effort that's being spearheaded by the Republican Party in America." Kurt Bardella, a former senior advisor to Republicans on the House Oversight Committee, added, "For Republicans like Mitt Romney and Liz Cheney, it says everything that they're still willing to be called Republicans, and it is the Republican Party's position to make it harder for minorities in America to vote." You look at the closing of voting locations in states like Georgia, where locations that have the highest density of minority voters are now having less options to go vote. Kurt Bardella concluded by saying, "That's pretty straightforward. That's pretty racist. It demonstrates the white privilege in play for people like Mitt Romney and Liz Cheney to not see that. The reality is, if they're not willing to move forward and assist in the effort to enact voter protections in America, then they're Donald Trump's biggest ally."
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
In the early hours of Sunday, massive explosions rocked the capital of Iraq's northern Kurdistan region, Erbil. A dozen ballistic missiles hit secret Mossad bases there, reportedly leaving several Israeli operatives dead. Then a statement came from Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC. The force said it had fired powerful and precision strike missiles targeting a strategic center for conspiracy and evil acts of the Zionists. The IRGC said the attack follows Israel's recent crimes and promised that those atrocities would not go unanswered. The IRGC warned that further Israeli acts of aggression would receive a tough, decisive, and destructive response. It underlined that the security of Iranian nationals was the red line of the country's armed forces. Israel has long been blamed for a wide range of anti-Iran measures, including acts of sabotage against its nuclear facilities and the assassination of Iranian scientists. Former Israeli officials have also confirmed the regime's role in the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in Iraq in 2020. And just last week, two IRGC officers were killed in an Israeli airstrike on the Syrian capital Damascus. At the time, the IRGC vowed that Israel would pay for the crime. In 2018, Israel killed a number of Iranians during an attack on an airbase near the city of Homs in western Syria. There have been a number of Iranian military advisors in Syria, as requested by the Damascus government. Iran later retaliated with a barrage of missiles targeting Israeli military positions in the occupied Golan Heights. The missile strike on Erbil could be seen in the same light. Iraq's Kurdistan regional government officials have denied the presence of Israeli bases in Erbil, but the two sides enjoy friendly ties. Back in 2014, Israel bought Kurdish oil despite opposition from the central Iraqi government and threats to take legal action. 3 years later, Israel endorsed an independence referendum carried out in the Kurdistan region. And last year, Erbil hosted a conference on normalization of ties between Iraq and Israel, prompting public outcry. The Kurdish regional government said it was not aware of the conference being organized. The IRGC says Iran's peace and security is a red line for the Iranian armed forces, and they will not allow any harm to come to the country. The IRGC says Iran's peace and security is a red line for Iranian armed forces, and they will not allow any harm to come to the country.
Iran's retaliatory strike against an informal Israeli base in Iraq, which was in response to an act of Israeli aggression in Syria, which resulted in the deaths of two members of Iran's Revolutionary Guards, serves as another stark reminder to Israel's ruling elite, namely that Iran has the intent and the capability to effectively respond to acts of Israeli aggression, either against Iran directly, or against Iranian interests in the Middle East, or against Iran's allies in the Middle East, such as Syria. And I am of the opinion that the Iranian retaliatory strike against the unofficial Israeli base in Iraq will not be lost on the Israeli ruling elite.
Syria and the Israeli regime are technically at war due to the latter's 1967 occupation of the Arab country's Golan Heights. The Israeli regime maintains a significant military presence in the territory, which it uses as a launchpad for its attacks on the Syrian soil. Israel has attacked Syria repeatedly through the past years. The reasons it provides fall short of being enough to justify the death and destruction that it has caused. Tel Aviv has been a key supporter of terrorist groups fighting to topple the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad since March 2011. The regime has also been providing safe passage and medical treatment to the Takfiri terrorists who flee the Allies' defensive operations. Israel's recent attack on the Syrian capital led to the martyrdom of two Iranian military advisors with the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The elite military force has been providing Syria with military advisory assistance in the face of foreign-sponsored militancy.
Iran has developed a very strong and a very robust armed forces which can meet Israeli aggression. Nonetheless, the Israelis, because of the unconditional support they receive year on year from Washington, will continue to act in the most criminal way possible.
Israel violates international law as well as international humanitarian law and refuses to implement dozens of resolutions or abide by recommendations put forward by relevant United Nations committees. Isn't it time the UN or other world countries gave this the attention that it deserves before the situation spirals out of control? The UN Security Council meeting turned into a heated argument between Moscow and Washington. The US and Russian delegates exchanged accusations over alleged biological weapons in Ukraine. The Russian envoy warned the European countries of the danger posed by Ukraine's research into biological weapons. Russia says the U.S.-funded biolabs have researched spreading the highly infectious bird flu virus through migratory birds and pathogens such as bacteria and viruses that can be transmitted from bats to humans. The U.S., however, rejected Russia's allegation of biological activities, claiming that biological laboratories in Ukraine have nothing to do with chemical arms. It also interpreted the accusation as a sign that Moscow plans to use chemical or biological weapons in Ukraine. Washington initially condemned Russia for spreading disinformation. Nevertheless, after Russia published documents showing that Kyiv was ordered to urgently eliminate traces of what was deemed as a biological weapons program financed by the Pentagon, U.S. Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland admitted the existence of U.S.-funded biological research facilities in the country, saying Washington is working with Kyiv to prevent Russia from getting the research materials. The contradictory remarks further deepen the world's doubts about the U.S. Why is the U.S. hastily attempting to destroy the materials? Is it trying to hide something?
Well, first of all, the United States specializes in moving its chemical and biological weapons activities away from its own territory to allow itself a degree of deniability. In other words, we didn't do that. It was a private venture of an academic institute or of a government department not related to the militaries.
The United States has spent more than $200 million on the work of biological laboratories in Ukraine. It has 30 biological laboratories and other related facilities in the country which are possibly involved in the production of bioweapons. And these are less than 10% of the 336 biological laboratories the U.S. reportedly controls in 30 countries around the world. Deputy Chairman of the Council of Ministers of Crimea, Georgi Muradov, says the United States had plans to open a biolab on the peninsula before its annexation to Russia. He also accused the Pentagon of developing biological weapons in its secret laboratories under Ukrainian territory. Also, China has called on the United States to release all-around details of its biological laboratories in Ukraine and urged relevant parties to ensure their safety. The U.S. has blocked the building of the Biological Weapons Convention Verification Protocol for 2 decades and refused to accept inspections of biological facilities within and outside its borders, despite having over 300 biological laboratories all over the world. It seems that by doing so, the U.S. wants to protect the secrets of its biological labs worldwide. It's reasonable and legitimate for the international community to question the U.S. for that, especially since it has a history of using chemical weapons. The U.S. dropped massive quantities of white phosphorus on the Iraqi city of Fallujah during an attack on the city in November 2004, killing insurgents and civilians with the appalling burns that are the signature of this weapon. Also, 5 decades after the Vietnam War ended, Agent Orange continues to impact communities in Vietnam and Laos today. It contained dioxin, one of the most toxic chemicals known to humans. It is linked to increased rates of cancers and birth defects. Vietnam says several million people have been affected by Agent Orange, including 150,000 children born with severe birth defects.
Well, the United States has always managed to present two faces to the world. One is the face of the American democracy attempting to achieve peace according to their propaganda, and the other is the military-industrial complex that runs the American economy by making wars. So the political element of the U.S. system denies involvement in such activities, while behind the back of the public, even the American public, is deceived in order to keep the regime popular at home. But behind the back of the American public, the United States is more involved than any other country in the world in these areas.
Biological weapons are seen as weapons of mass destruction together with nuclear and chemical weapons. Any suspicion of biological weapons must be promptly investigated. Therefore, the U.S. owes the world an answer on what it has been up to in its so-called biological research facilities in Ukraine.
September 11, 2001. The United States is hit by four coordinated terrorist attacks, the first major assault on the U.S. soil since World War II. Nearly 3,000 people are killed and some 20,000 others injured. The U.S. responds with an all-out war on Afghanistan, where the terror group Al-Qaeda that planned and carried out the attack was said to be based. Fast forward 20 years. U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order in September giving the Justice Department a six-month notice to release the documents on the FBI's investigations into the incident. Yet on Thursday, the department acknowledged that it would miss the deadline, suggesting that they would be released by mid-April. It says the delay is due to continuing coordination with a number of foreign governments and ongoing interagency review. One of the governments in question is likely to be Saudi Arabia. Out of 19 terrorists involved in the attacks, 15 were Saudi nationals. The close ties between Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and the Saudi royal family also raised questions that Saudi Arabian authorities supported the operation. Some observers believe the conflict in Ukraine and the West's sweeping sanctions on Russia, especially its energy sector, which has sent fuel prices skyrocketing around the world, could explain the delay in the release of the documents, as the United States needs Saudi Arabia, with the world's second largest oil reserves, to fill in the gap.
And obviously there's a quid pro quo going on here. How serious it's going to be is another question. You still got hanging over all of this the fact that Vice President Cheney at the time, in 9/11, arranged for all these Saudis to leave the country, leave the United States and go back to Saudi Arabia. So there was no follow-up at the time, contemporaneously, with the Saudi presence in the United States, or the fact that most of the people who were involved in the actual hijackings of these planes were Saudis. So clearly, there is something here that is extremely troubling. And clearly, the Saudis do not want this out. And I suspect there are large sections of the United States government who are not interested in having a serious discussion about this.
But the delay isn't good news to thousands of families who are seeking justice for the loved ones they lost on 9/11. Soon after taking office, Joe Biden said the U.S. was ending all its support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen, proclaiming that the war has to end. But, back in September, the U.S. State Department approved its first major arms sale to the kingdom under President Biden, with the sale of 280 air-to-air missiles valued at up to $650 million. President Biden has broken another promise about defending humanitarian rights, an issue he staked much of his presidency on. Back in February, a declassified U.S. intelligence report concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman authorized a team of Saudi security and intelligence officials to kill dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. But Biden later decided not to punish bin Salman, saying it would be diplomatically unprecedented for the United States.
It's unlikely that people are going to support the United States in the hour of need without some concessions. I mean, I just don't see it. It's possible, I suppose. Maybe there's some threats or whatever, but it's unlikely. And the Saudis have been very clear in the paper today. They said they want more support by the United States for their adventure in Yemen, among other things. There was a list.
The U.S. takes in stride the violations perpetrated by its allies while accusing countries it deems its adversaries of the same charges. But will it forgive possible perpetrators of attacks on its own citizens too? What message would that have for the attackers? Wouldn't that embolden them to commit even worse crimes, knowing that they can get away with murder in its most literal sense?
As the war between Russia and Ukraine drags on, there are indications that Ukraine has hosted US-funded labs to develop biological weapons. U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Victoria Nuland has admitted that Ukraine hosts biological research facilities.
Ukraine has biological research facilities, which, in fact, we are now quite concerned Russian troops, Russian forces may be seeking to gain control of. So we are working with the Ukrainians on how they can prevent any of those research materials from falling into the hands of Russian forces.
So that Victoria Nuland, the guru of the Maidan, who was passing out cookies to the fascist Azov battalion in 2014 during the coup against the legitimate government, was forced to admit that these facilities were there. She didn't clarify what they were exactly, but she indicated that that they were dismantled quickly in order to prevent them from falling into the hands of the Russians.
The admission came after Russia published documents showing that Kiev was ordered to urgently eliminate traces of what was deemed as a biological weapons program financed by the Pentagon. The dangerous pathogens across Ukrainian biolab facilities included anthrax, the plague, tularemia, cholera, and other deadly diseases. In the past several days, long-standing fears, which we have expressed repeatedly for years, regarding the development of military biological materials by the United States on the territory of Ukraine under the auspices of the relevant U.S. Special Services have been confirmed. Earlier, the Russian Defense Ministry said it had found evidence of U.S.-funded biolabs in Ukraine, which had urgently destroyed samples of deadly pathogens when the military offensive started.
I think the United States was caught by surprise now. At first, they've been denying all the accusations that are being made, you know, over the past few months that they're conducting biological warfare research. You had this incident here, which initially they really couldn't deny.
Russia says U.S. statements about Ukraine's biolabs indicate fears by Washington that the pathogens stored there may fall into the hands of Russian experts. Moscow says they confirmed the U.S.'s violation of the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention.
So either through surrogate or directly, the United States seems to have been involved in creating a capability that would give a country, an allied country, or the United States a possibility to conduct biological warfare. And that, of course, is forbidden by a variety of UN conventions.
Russia says it had been closely monitoring the bioweapons programs that were developed by the Pentagon in post-Soviet countries. Russia has accused the U.S. of working in Ukraine since 2005 and being involved in the construction, modernization, and operation of over a dozen biolabs suitable for storing or working with pathogens, including those used in bioweapons.
The fact that they existed in Ukraine, where there was a almost obsessive concern and hatred, I must say, among some of the leading factions, right-wing factions in the Ukrainian government against Russia, that they, I think, would be quite prepared to use them in a war with someone they considered their deadly foe. And if they did so, it was with the full backing of the United States, who set up these facilities in the first place.
Moscow has expressed deep concerns about these facilities in recent years. Moscow says facilities in Ukraine were developing components for biological weapons, noting that in the near future, the ministry would release its analysis of the received documents. Russia also accuses the U.S. of sponsoring biological labs across a number of former Soviet republics, including Kazakhstan, Armenia, Tajikistan, and Georgia.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 19:20 to 20:20. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the televised speech delivered on March 1st, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Mab'ath. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure progeny, especially the one remaining with God on earth. I congratulate the entire great Islamic Ummah, the dear Iranian nation, and all liberated individuals in the world on the occasion of the auspicious and grand Eid al-Mab'ath. Ba'tha is the day when the greatest divine gift was bestowed on the Holy Prophet of Islam. God's greatest servant in Mab'ath Eve prayer, Ba'tha, has been described as the great light. Of course, the Holy Prophet's Ba'tha is a gift to all of humanity as well. If we only consider two values from among all Islamic values, the expansion of rationality and the cultivation of morality, of course, Islamic values are vast in scope, but those two values are outstanding. And if we wish to see what Islam has mentioned about these two values, we will confirm that Islam has given the best gift and the means for bliss to humanity.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The fact that Islam invites people to the expansion of rationality is very important. There are tens of, and perhaps about 100, ayahs and verses in which God, the Exalted, invites people to thinking and deliberating with terminologies such as thinking, learning, understanding, and the like. As for the expansion and cultivation of morality, it would be enough to say that Islam has placed morality at the top of the goals of Ba'atha. In several ayahs of verses in the Holy Quran, morality has been highlighted, such as in this verse, "It is He who has sent amongst the unlettered an apostle from among themselves to recite them His signs, to purify them." Chapter 62, verse 2. There are other ayahs and verses in the Holy Quran in which morality has been mentioned as the goal of Ba'atha. Morality is at the top of all goals. Therefore, Islam has given these two lofty values to humanity and has invited believers and all human beings to think and to cultivate morality. This is the biggest gift that Islam could have given to humanity.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The United Nations WFP has expressed concern about the situation of children in Afghanistan, announcing that acute malnutrition rates are high in 28 out of 34 provinces of the country. The UN body says 3.5 million Afghan children currently need nutrition treatment. The head of Indira Gandhi Children's Hospital believes this situation is due to cuts in global aid and mass poverty triggered by U.S. sanctions.
Due to poverty, most Afghan mothers can't afford enough nutrients at the time of pregnancy. When the mother herself suffers from undernutrition, the baby, of course, becomes malnourished. In addition to providing milk and nutrients, health bodies should also provide such families with some cash aid for a specific period of time so that the mother and children don't face malnourishment after recovering.
Some Afghan mothers also say they can't provide their babies with needed nutrition, as their entire families are going without food to eat.
I'm a widow. I can't afford a packet of flour to cook bread. My family members are going without food to eat. There is no male breadwinner in our household. This daughter of mine is malnourished, and I'm afraid the other children also become undernourished if this situation continues.
The UNHCR says that at the Antalya Diplomacy Forum, everyone agreed that in spite of the extreme gravity of the Ukraine situation, other crises, including that of Afghanistan, must not be forgotten. Afghans are also calling on Western powers not to ignore the crisis they caused in Afghanistan.
Western powers caused the situation in our country.
They imposed the war and control everything here. Today they are shifting all attention to the Ukraine crisis. That is important, but what about Afghans' plight? They shouldn't forget poor and suffering Afghans.
Following the Taliban takeover, the U.S. froze some $9 billion in Afghan central bank assets and major funding to the country was halted. The developments affected lives across the country. The situation is still perilous in Afghanistan, where millions of lives depend on foreign aid. Afghan people are calling on world countries not to forget them and to continue their assistance to the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Majlis-e-Wahdat Muslimin is holding this emergency press conference after the same past patterns of Shia targeted killings emerge in the country, where killers either going scot-free or sectarian hate mongers are allowed to spread venom against Shia Muslims.
Participants here say that the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan has miserably failed to make needed structural changes against hate mongering to root out this threat from the society.
After the recent carnage in Peshawar Mosque, Shia-targeted killings gained momentum in the port city of Karachi, where leaders of Shia communities Pasmane Azhar Salman Haider was gunned down before his house, signalling another wave of Shia-targeted killing following the same decades-old patterns.
This press conference is about the start of new wave of targeted killings in Pakistan and the overall declining security situation in the country, which is evident that Khan administration at center has changed its priorities and cannot deliver on its promises. First in Quetta, then in Peshawar, and now targeted killing in Karachi. If enemy states are doing this, then where are our security institutions whose job is to safeguard Pakistani lives?
Imran Khan's government made promises to all Pakistanis to go against foreign-funded hate mongers and will implement National Action Plan in its full spirit to eradicate these sectarian elements from the country. But unfortunately, in the last 3 years, this government has done no implementation of the National Action Plan, and as a result came this new wave of Shia-targeted killings across the country.
Shia Muslims have seen carnages in Pakistan over the last 3 decades. They believe it is the direct consequence of the Takfiri ideology promoted in Pakistan by certain regional states. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
With the Persian New Year, or Nowruz, being just around the corner in Iran, people are getting prepared to welcome the arrival of spring. This comes as the sixth wave of coronavirus in Iran appears to have been subsiding now. The official daily number of fatalities, which had stood at 241 on February 27th, fell to below 120 over the past couple of days. The Persian New Year, or Nowruz, arrives on March 21st. The Nowruz holidays are traditionally a time when Iranians travel and visit each other. But health officials are worried that the exchange of visits and travels during the Persian New Year will lead to a new wave of COVID-19 if health protocols are not fully observed.
In view of the special feature of the Omicron variant, we highly request people to keep wearing masks and observe social distancing. Although many of them have been vaccinated, wearing a mask is still an important measure, especially when they are visiting relatives and friends during Nowruz.
I think everyone should receive the third dose of vaccine. And if you want to be safe, we should postpone our visiting and travels to some other time. If we don't take Omicron seriously, the next wave will sweep across the country again.
I have recovered from coronavirus almost 20 days now, but too much coughing hurts me a lot, and symptoms are still with me and my daughter. It's a bad disease, and people should not forget to observe the health protocols.
According to official statistics, over 56 million Iranians have received the second jabs of vaccines, while over 24 million others have been vaccinated with the third shot.
Under the travel rules released for Iran's third Nowruz with COVID-19, only those who have received at least 2 doses of vaccines are allowed to travel by their private cars across the country during the Persian New Year holidays. Otherwise, they will be fined. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Islamic Suhada in Adwar, what a
people in the blockaded Gaza Strip attended a big ceremony to mark the 54th anniversary of the Palestinian Wounded Persons Day. The annual event pays tribute to the tens of thousands of Palestinians who got injured during Israeli wars and aggressions. Thousands of injured Palestinians suffered from permanent disabilities during Israeli wars. Israeli forces have also injured some 30,000 peaceful Palestinian protesters who were taking part in the Great March of Return rallies. Hamas movement, which organized the event, accused the Israeli regime of committing crimes against the Palestinian people.
The amount, the volume, the size of the injury indicated that we are facing a criminal side, which is occupation. I think it is very important indication about the type and the impact of the Israeli actions, Israeli crimes against the Palestinian.
During the Israeli war in May of 2021, over 2,200 Palestinians were injured, including 685 children and 480 women, some of whom may suffer a long-term disability requiring rehabilitation.
We have to stress the role of the wounded in Palestine and their great role. They are Palestinian, wounded are in the first line with the occupation. So they sacrifice with their bodies in order to, free Palestine.
Palestinians say that Tel Aviv's crimes will continue to go unpunished as long as it enjoys protection from Western countries. The Islamic Jihad movement accused the United States of encouraging Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people.
I think that who give the Israeli the green lights, Americans, the United States of America, and the silence of people, which silenced all over the massacre which carried by the Israelis against our people, and also maybe the Arab position, so that the Israelis go on to hit, to destroy, to kill, to injure everything against our people.
The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has made it even worse for wounded Gazans who require rehabilitation and artificial limbs.
Israeli forces have killed and injured thousands of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip since 2008, amid what observers describe as an international conspiracy of silence. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
South Korea elected a new president Wednesday as conservative People Power Party candidate Yoon Suk-yeol defeated progressive Lee Jae-myung by less than 1% after all the votes were tallied. Yoon was quick to outline the hard line he will take with North Korea.
In order to protect the safety of our people, property, territory, and sovereignty, we will build a strong military capacity that can reliably suppress any provocation. I'll firmly deal with illicit, unreasonable behavior by North Korea in a principled manner, though I'll always leave the door for South-North talks open.
North Korea conducted several missile tests in the weeks leading up to the election. Some analysts believe President-elect Yoon, a former prosecutor entering politics for the first time, will face some early challenges from Pyongyang.
The Conservative Party has been very critical of the government's position on military exercises. Of course, South Korea will come out with a new North Korea policy, but North Korea will also conduct a couple of activities to test the Yoon administration. I'm not sure whether this will lead to conflict or dialogue.
The Moon Jae-in administration had sought engagement with North Korea, but its policies were often stymied by a hardline U.S. approach. Yoon Suk-yeol's foreign policy marks a stark turnaround from outgoing President Moon Jae-in, particularly concerning North Korea. Yoon advocates the deployment of a second U.S. anti-ballistic missile battery to protect the capital, Seoul, the resumption of joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises, and the preparation for South Korea's military to execute a preemptive strike on North Korea should Pyongyang pose an imminent threat. In addition to the difficult North Korea issue, President-elect Yoon will have to deal with a raft of domestic problems, including a housing price bubble and income gap, a surge in COVID-19, as well as rising inflation. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A Cult in Heart of the Republic is the title of a book written by a member of the French Senate, Nathalie Goulet.
In her book, she shines a light into the formidable anti-Iran terror group known as Mojahedin-e-Khalq Organization, or simply the MKO. The author tries to warn her fellow Senate members that a full-scale terror group exists in the heart of the French Republic. Here, in Iran's city of Qom, political thinkers and activists have gathered to unveil the first Persian translation of the French book.
In the book, A Cult in Heart of the Republic, Mrs. Goulet writes about the grisly crimes against humanity perpetrated by the MKO and how they crushed all humanitarian principles to ascend to power in Iran. The author warns the French parliament that the formidable group now enjoys full financial support from Paris and is infiltrating into the French government.
The group also fought alongside Iraqi forces against Iran during the eight-year Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s.
During the early days of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the group tried to take power in Iran. But when they failed because of lack of popularity, they tried to deal a blow to the Islamic Republic. The MKO brainwashes its members and does not allow them to get married and form a family. They are like a war machine, which are designed to kill.
In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist organization. The terror group was then relocated from an American military base in Iraq to Albania and France. Since then, the U.S. and Europe have been taking part in the MKO's annual summits in Paris. Natalie Golay's book tries to highlight the criminal track record of the MKO, while warning France that it's making a big mistake by supporting the terror group.
France is a country that claims to care about money laundering on the global stage. But based on Nathalie Goulet's book, the French government is conducting large-scale money laundering to fund the MKO terrorists. The U.S. also lends its political support to the terror group. This is both double standards and folly, because the MKO's functionality has long expired.
The MKO is currently led by 68-year-old Maryam Rajavi, who is facing pressure from French human rights entities as, quote, a smear on France's record of human rights advocacy.
Aside from warning France of the security threats posed to her country by the MKO, the French author says capitalizing on the terror group is nothing but a waste of time and money. She argues that the MKO is viewed as an obsolete killing machine in the minds of Iranians and has no place in Iran's sociopolitical structure. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Qom.
Massive explosions lit up the night sky over Erbil, the capital of Iraq's northern Kurdistan region, in the early hours of Sunday. Initial reports pointed to the detonation of as many as 12 ballistic missiles. Then a statement came from Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC. The force said it had fired powerful and precision strike missiles, targeting a strategic Israeli center for conspiracy and villainy. The IRGC said the attack follows Israel's recent crimes and promised that those atrocities would not go unanswered. The IRGC warned that further Israeli acts of aggression would receive a tough, decisive, and destructive response. Israel has long been blamed for a wide range of anti-Iran measures, including acts of sabotage against its nuclear facilities and the assassination of Iranian scientists. Former Israeli officials have also confirmed the regime's role in the U.S. assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani in Iraq in 2020. And just last week, two IRGC officers were killed in an Israeli airstrike on the Syrian capital, Damascus. At the time, the IRGC vowed that Israel would pay for the crime. In 2018, Israel killed a number of Iranians during an attack on an airbase near the city of Homs in western Syria. Iran later retaliated with a barrage of missiles targeting Israeli military positions in the occupied Golan Heights. The missile strike on Erbil could be seen in the same light. Iraq's Kurdistan regional government officials have denied the presence of Israeli bases in Erbil, but the two sides enjoy friendly ties. Back in 2014, Israel bought Kurdish oil despite opposition from the central Iraqi government and threats to take legal action. 3 years later, Israel endorsed an independence referendum carried out in the Kurdistan region. And last year, Erbil hosted a conference on normalization of ties between Iraq and Israel, prompting a furore. The Kurdish regional government said it was not aware of the conference being organized. Some analysts believe Israel is pursuing